The Republicans are completely evil. They are unscrupulous, and they will stop at nothing to hold power and to destroy our democracy and risk our lives if we continue to allow them. So it is really strategically critical that we deny them the opportunity to do that, just as they have done their best to deny us the opportunity to have a basic democratic voice for decades. And it's important to start at the local level so that you build a farm team of talented, principled people who can work their way up the ladder of hierarchy over time.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was very glad to have the chance to talk with Peter Shurman. Peter is the program director at Contest Every Race. Contest Every Race uses text messaging to recruit first-time Democratic candidates for local office, from school board to state legislature, in many thousands of races where no Democrat would run otherwise. Peter was formerly the founding executive director at MoveOn.org. Contest Every Race is a program that produces tangible results for its efforts. Democrats holding offices that they would not otherwise. Better attitudes towards the party and reverse coattails up the ballot. It's a good example of how to design a new program to fit into the progressive ecosystem, and Peter is a good person to know about. You should consider giving them your support, by the way. So, first our sponsor, then my interview with Peter Shurman and Contest Every Race.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Peter, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. Hi, my name is Peter Shurman, and I run the Contest Every Race program. And we use text messaging to recruit Democrats to run for local elected office in places where no Democrat would otherwise run or has run in decades. I've been working in progressive politics for close to 30 years now, and I was previously the first executive director at MoveOn. As well as working in the environmental movement for many years and in government reform for many years.
Yeah, you have a notable, interesting biography in the space and feel honored to have your time here. And I want to kind of go through that biography with you, but first I want to talk a little bit about Contest Every Race since it's your current project. It's an intriguing one. There's some kind of interesting combination of using technology to do a kind of a more mundane local thing, something that maybe you would think the party would do, but explain why it's important to contest every race and what you're doing that's helping us do that.
Well, first of all, thank you. And I'm honored to be here. And this is an amazing podcast. You've had so many illustrious guests, and you've probably heard of the Powell memo, the then future Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, many decades ago. He wrote up a plan for basically how conservatives could take over American government at all levels. And it began by packing local offices with right-wing ideologues, school board, city council, county auditor, those kind of offices that are, you know, usually fly below the radar of most people who pay attention to national politics and even state politics. They began there, and at every step, these folks got into office and worked their way up the power pyramid. And at every stage, we've seen them relentlessly lock out Democrats and progressives from even the basics of participation, as well as rolling back critical environmental laws, you know, voting rights laws, anything you can think of. They are relentless and unscrupulous. And we have been losing and paying the price ever since. Now, state and national Democratic parties typically just, they have so much to think about with the presidential races coming up, with the big technology infrastructure decisions they have to make, with all the endorsement stuff, all the money they have to raise. Most of their attention goes to the presidential race, the Senate races, the statewide races, the state legislative races. The reality is they rarely have time to focus on the bottom of the ticket. Everybody knows it's important. Everyone knows it's a priority, but it takes time and effort to recruit somebody for these local offices. And a lot of times they just don't get to it with a whole lot of resources or attention. And so the result of that has been that for the last few decades, you know, of the more than 500,000 elected offices in the United States, Democrats typically haven't even fielded a candidate in up to 70% of those races. So it's no wonder that we have a challenge in terms of facing this really daunting power structure right now. So Contest Every Race has been around for about two and a quarter years, and we've set out to do our best to fill that gap. So we use text messaging, which is, you know, the best way to get through to people with technology these days. And we have an amazing team of about 100 research volunteers who commit hours and hours once we go into a state to calling up all of the city clerks, the county clerks, finding out who are the incumbent school board members who are up for election this year in some remote county in the middle of Pennsylvania, and finding out who are the incumbents. Then we research which of those incumbents are Republicans and which are Democrats. And as a general matter, we essentially recruit Democrats to run in every race with a Republican incumbent. There's also sometimes races where a Democratic incumbent might be retiring. There are sometimes races, believe it or not, where there's actually a decent Republican in office. And the folks we work with will say, hey, you know, let's leave this person alone. And we do. But in general, we end up, when we go into a state, we partner closely with the state Democratic Party and with major constituency groups such as MoveOn.org, the League of Conservation Voters, the Service Employees International Union, the American Federation of Teachers, the NEA, as well as with great groups that specialize in candidate recruitment, such as the National Democratic Training Committee, with Run for Something. We also work with Mi Gente, with Black Voters Matter. We've worked with Emerge. Great groups. And we text all of the Democrats on the voter file in those localities, those remote small towns that have Republican entrenched incumbents. We text all the MoveOn members, all the LCV members, etc. And we send a text that says something like, hey, Nathaniel, I'm Peter. I'm a volunteer with the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. We're looking for someone to run for local office where you live. Would you be interested in information on how to run? And if you say, well, I don't know, tell me more, that's great. That opts you in to receiving a further series of about 10 to 20 texts over the next 8 weeks, where we give you everything you will need to get from a cold start to across the starting line as a filed candidate for local office. And I can go more into what those texts consist of. But that is the gist of it. We pull people out of the woodwork and into the electoral process. We've recruited nearly 1,000 candidates so far across 12 states, and two-thirds of them are women or people of color. And all of these are in races where no Democrat would have run otherwise. And amazingly, of these people whom you might think they wouldn't have much of a chance, almost half of them are winning their races. 49% of those who faced elections so far have won.
It's fascinating. I'm struck by a couple things. One, like 1,000 offices is a lot for, you know, just sort of spraying recruitment out there like that. It's also a tiny number compared to the 500,000 office figure you gave. Does that mean that we're coming up way, way short? There should be a whole lot more of this. Of that 500,000, how many are offices that really fit the criteria that you're interested in?
Sure. So the short answer is we're just getting started. We've only been doing this for 2 years. We're ramping up and we're having amazing success so far. Part of the answer is we don't target every single race in a state because there are a lot of races that are in the urban centers where there's plenty of Democrats who either are incumbents or are lining up to run or are likely to be recruited to run. We end up focusing almost exclusively in the more rural parts, currently of battleground states, but once we get past 2020, we'll be going into deeper red and deeper blue states to make sure we are contesting every race. We've just done 12 states so far, and in typically those states, we will get asked to recruit for anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand races. We started out with a few hundred in most of our states. In Pennsylvania, we were asked to recruit for 3,500 races. We found candidates in 256 of them, and 156 of those candidates won. That's when we were really just getting started. Lately, in Colorado and Georgia and North Carolina, again, we've had a few hundred races in each of those states where we've been asked to recruit by the party. These are the places where they really knew they needed help. And we've found candidates to fill those races in more than a quarter of those races in each of those states, in more than a third of them in Colorado. So as we continue to ramp up, people are seeing that we can be successful and that this can work. Right now in Michigan, we're recruiting for 7,000 races. That's just a huge number. And so we're just super excited to see what the outcome of these is going to be. And we're confident that we're going to continue to grow this program. So we're filling a much higher number of those races.
7,000 races. What's your, say in Michigan, what's your sense of how the other side deals with that? Like, do they have candidates in those 7,000 races? Or they face, is it fairly similar where like they can't find anybody to run in the urban centers? What's the balance of recruitment and sort of globally across the state from what you can see?
In the 7,000 races we're targeting, those are races with Republican incumbents. So yes, they definitely have candidates in those races. To stretch outside their territory, as you said, they're going to have to go into the major metro areas. To be candid with you, I have no idea what their penetration is with major metro areas. But from having lived in cities most of my life, I know that most of the places I've lived, you tend to see Republicans raise the flag every once in a while, and sometimes they get elected. When I first moved to Berkeley, California, there was a UC Berkeley professor who was on the Berkeley City Council. He was a poli-sci professor, and he had banners everywhere, and he was a Republican. And they just kind of, they find a way to, at least in the past, they found a way to fly the Republican flag and not get shot down. And I hope and pray that that era is over and that we're on the cusp of an era when the Republican brand is so toxic that nobody will ever vote for Republican again. But I'm not quite ready to assume that that's true.
What's sort of the founding story for Contest Every Race? Whose idea was it originally? How did you personally become involved?
The idea came from a brilliant guy that I work with named Yoni Landau, and he's the founder of an organization called Resistance Labs that was originally called Rapid Resist, and he created it to use text messaging to provide support for a whole lot of basically anti-Trump protest events soon after Trump was inaugurated. And over time, it has grown and morphed into being a company that provides texting services to a whole range of progressive candidates and campaigns. Essentially, the insight was that the state Democratic parties, although they have a lot on their plates and they tend not to focus on these local races, they do have an infrastructure of county Democratic Party chairs who are wonderful people. They work super hard out of the goodness of their hearts, and they do their best locally. And there's a chair, a Democratic Party chair, in probably 90% of the counties across the country. There are many that don't even have a chair, but there are most of them do. And these chairs are a terrific resource to complement the otherwise possibly somewhat impersonal nature of a text message. And that was really the kernel of his initial insight. Send a text message to people who live in places with races that would otherwise go uncontested. If the people opt in, set up a meeting between them and their county chair to encourage them to run for office. So that's the kernel that we started with about 2.25 years ago in Kansas, of all places. And we did really well in Kansas, and then we did pretty well in Texas, and then incredibly well in Oklahoma. And at every stage, we've added additional resources. that meeting with the county chair is still the highest value add of the sequence that we offer. If you say yes, you might be open to running for local office. But we also provide a training program from the National Democratic Training Committee, resources from Run for Something, usually a training program from Run for Something if you qualify by being less than 40 years old. We do extensive research. We tell you what are the specific local offices where you live that we're recruiting for. We send you out a quick blurb of what's involved in serving in those offices. We research exactly which forms you need to file to become a candidate for those particular offices. So it's not like go to your Secretary of State's website and look in the election section and, you know, try to scratch your head and figure out which of 800 links apply to you. We make it super easy. We send you a link right to the form that you need. And if, for example, there's a filing fee you have to pay, it might depend on which office you run for. We research that information and pop that information for your particular office right into the text that we send you. So everything is as turnkey as it can possibly be, short of you making the decision to step up and run. And then if you do step up and run, we send you a whole bunch of other great resources to help you be successful, including we send you volunteers, we send you an opportunity to have texting support from Resistance Labs. We provide you with candidate coaching, just a whole bunch of resources. And over time, with all of this focused attention to detail and the dedication of an amazing team that we work with here, really just incredibly dedicated people, we've been able to show, I think, really considerable success.
So how did you get involved?
I was frankly looking for something to do a couple of years ago. And Yoni and I went to the same graduate program at the Yale School of Management, which is, you know, mostly people who end up going into consulting or, you know, finance, although he was just about 10 years younger than I am. So we didn't know each other through the school directly. He reached out to me a few years later, and we both went on a path of trying to take what we learned in school to helping build progressive organizations. So we were kind of simpatico on that level. And he told me he had this idea. For many years, I've thought that the recruitment of candidates, the building a pipeline of Democratic candidates, is this big unmet opportunity. And I get excited about unmet opportunities. So I was pretty excited to work on this.
I'm assuming that one of the really important reasons to contest every race is that you have all those candidates working to get out the vote, that you get sort of reverse coattails that boil up to other offices as well as winning the ones that you win. And but what do you think are all the good reasons to be recruiting and to be contesting these races?
Well, there are so many good reasons. And you brought up an excellent point about reverse coattails. One of the best reasons right now, President Obama highlighted this in his graduation speech to the nation. And I'll paraphrase a little, but he basically said, you got your policy goals, but in order to get your policy goals enacted, you have to elect good people at all levels, down to the local level, down to mayors and city councils, who have, in many cases, the most direct impact on issues like policing. So it's highly relevant today, especially today, in terms of the direct impact that electing good people can have on policies and enforcement and implementation. So that's one good reason. Another good reason is the power structure. The Republicans are completely evil. They are unscrupulous, and they will stop at nothing to hold power and to destroy our democracy and risk our lives if we continue to allow them. So it is really strategically critical that we deny them the opportunity to do that, just as they have done their best to deny us the opportunity to have a basic democratic voice for decades. And it's important to start at the local level so that you build a farm team of talented, principled people who can work their way up the ladder of hierarchy over time. Now, that's how, you know, some really awful people on the right got their start. Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, who did so much to destroy the democracy in that state, comes to mind. He was one of these recruited ideologues. They cultivated him really young and pushed him all the way up through the chain. And, you know, we're seeing the results. I'm pretty sure something similar is true of Brian Kemp in Georgia. So it's important to close the pipeline to Republicans, put good Democrats in the pipeline, support them in local governance, and support them as they move their way up.
You're talking about good people and talented, principled people. How can it be that the best way to find such folks is to text through a voter file? Like typically, recruitment that I've seen before targeted people who are active in certain ways or had some kind of vetting. What's the theory behind we're going to get all good people? Because, you know, we have some cranks in our world too that might run. And do you do any vetting?
So the reality is that most of where the rubber meets the road for our program is in these tiny municipalities. And I mean, like populations between, you know, 500 and 3,000. These are the deep rural areas where Democrats are just not going to have a candidate otherwise. And the alternative is an entrenched Republican, typically an old white guy who's had no opposition for years, maybe decades. And these people are Republicans. And that may not mean much on a day-to-day basis for the people in their town. They might think this person's a fine fellow or whatever. But functionally, what that means is that, you know, this elected official is part of the national apparatus of, frankly, evil that is destroying everything that makes America worth fighting for. So by definition, anybody who is not a Republican is better than anyone who is in any elected office. That may sound like a simplistic answer because it's not the whole answer. We also give an opportunity for those county Democratic Party chairs to meet with these candidates and to assess them. You know, they can tell pretty quickly, is this person a crank or is this person, you know, reasonably poised and articulate, and are they going to, you know, potentially do a good job? Are they a normal person? Do they have a good head on their shoulders? You can get most of that in 10 seconds. But, you know, they obviously have a meeting and they'll assess the candidates. And we always say, if you have any concerns about any of these folks we pull out of the woodwork, just tell us. And, you know, so far, that's never happened. Nobody has ever flagged concern about anybody who we've happened to reach. We also do offer the option for more rigorous vetting through, you know, various types of research that we can do. It costs a little more, and the Democratic parties in the states typically don't take us up on it, but we do offer it. And the reality is, it's kind of like, it's like the wisdom of crowds, it's the law of large numbers. You tend to get people who are reasonable. And frankly, to do a better job than Republicans, it doesn't take much more than being reasonable.
If people who are listening feel like they'd like to help your operation, you mentioned you have research volunteers. I'm assuming you wouldn't mind contributions. How can people be helpful?
Thank you so much for asking. Contributions are where it's at right now. We would be so grateful for contributions. ContestEveryRace.com/donate. ContestEveryRace.com/donate would be the place to go. You can also go to ContestEveryRace.com, and there are places you can fill out. You're being interested in volunteering to be part of our research team. We would be super grateful for that. Nathaniel, I'd love to come back to the question you asked me about two questions ago about reverse coattails, because I didn't quite answer that part of that question.
Please.
Reverse coattails is such an important point. In addition to the impact on local governance and on, you know, filling the candidate pipeline, we do have an impact on Democratic voting success all the way up the ballot. And that shows up in a few ways. The way we know this, first of all, is that, you know, typically in a state, we will run a randomized control trial so we can measure our impact. And usually that looks like we will, once we've filtered out all the races that we're targeting, we will end up having on the order of about 100,000 people whom we can text in those red localities. And we typically hold back about 20,000 people for a control group. And then we, at the conclusion of the campaign, our research volunteers call up all those county clerks again and get the full list of everybody who's filed. And then we run those names and phone numbers against the people we did text and the people we didn't text, and we measure our results. And we found great results in terms of our direct effect on candidate recruitment. Before I get to the reverse coattails, we found across texting tests of upwards of 500,000 people texted that we make a 28% difference in improving candidate recruitment. And that's statistically significant. We've also found important impacts on voting behavior in general. So One of those is that if you get a text compared to if you don't, you're going to feel about 4 to 5% more warmly toward the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party has showed up where you live and showed that they actually take an interest in local elections. And that's pretty important. We've also found that in counties where we text versus counties where we don't, Democratic candidates get an average of 12,000 more votes. And similarly, we found that in places where we recruit a candidate, amazingly enough, there are Democrats who for some reason didn't show up to vote in 2016. In Oklahoma, for example. And in Oklahoma, we texted a lot of those people in 2018. And of those people who had skipped the 2016 presidential election, Democrats who had skipped the 2016 presidential election, these are the people that we've absolutely got to turn out to win this current 2020 election year. They were 0.9% more likely to vote in places where we recruited a Democratic candidate onto the local ballot, compared to in places where we didn't. And there was no corresponding boost on the GOP side. So there's three rigorously measured examples right there of how recruiting a local candidate brings friends and neighbors out of, you know, they get up off their couch, they don't stay home, they show up and they vote. And those votes help Democrats win higher up the ticket, reverse coattails, just like you said.
What else should we know about Contest Every Race that you haven't covered?
I think it's so exciting to imagine what can happen if we continue to do this work. As I said, we've just gotten started. We're honored to work with an amazing steering committee comprised of leaders of great organizations, the National Democratic Training Committee, Run for Something, Civitas Public Affairs, MoveOn.org, Resistance Labs. We have an amazing advisory board. Keith Ellison is on our advisory board. The state chairs of the Mississippi and Pennsylvania and Georgia Democratic parties are on our advisory board. Sarah Schreiber from America Votes. And this is a growing program, and it's outside the conventional spotlight. So we do need your support, and we'd be very grateful for it.
It's good to see something like this fitting into, you know, clearly knows how to fit itself into the progressive ecosystem. And it seems pretty clear that the results can be really valuable. So glad you're up to that. Do you mind if I kind of walk through your biography? I think it's important for people to know, like, how people end up in positions like this that matter.
Sure.
So where do you come from? Like, what kind of family? And take me through your education. You mentioned, you know, Yale MBA, but I know you went to UPenn, but like, how'd you get going?
Wow. I never get asked these questions. I'm getting a little shy all of a sudden. So I was born in Boston. I grew up in a family of activists and Quakers. I have to acknowledge my great grandmother, who was a lifelong activist and had been a worker for women's suffrage in her youth in the early part of the 20th century. My mom was an environmentalist. My dad worked in historic preservation of old buildings and sort of redeveloping communities in derelict old but beautiful buildings, especially in Portland, Maine, the old port of Portland, Maine. My dad was redeveloping during some of my younger years when we lived in Portland, Maine. In college, I gravitated towards studying history because I just wanted to understand what happens in the world and why, because it's pretty confusing. And I found it enlightening. And I ended up, in particular, studying a lot of Middle Eastern history, which was especially confusing until you look really closely. And in my senior year at Penn, it was 1991. And of course, that's when the Gulf War started. And I felt for the first time in my life like I understood enough about a current issue to have a real stand on it that was my own and didn't come from my family. And I was particularly struck by a statistic that we were hearing at the time that 80% of the public supported the war, ostensibly. And I just didn't jive with what I was seeing around me. So I was maybe a little bit of a freak, but I started walking around my campus and asking people that I knew slightly or people I didn't even know, hey, what do you think about this war? What do you think about this war? Do you think it's a good idea? And most of the people that I encountered said, well, I'm not really sure, but I don't see what choice we have. My suspicion was that that sense of an absence of choice was being spun as 80% support, which was the headline that was being used to kind of browbeat people into this feeling of, you know, compulsory patriotism at the time, which I was very disturbed by. But it also kind of, it opened the door for me to kind of experience how electrifying it can be to be an activist. And, you know, I just loved the experience of, you know, sitting in a circle with maybe 50 people trying to figure out what on earth we might be able to do to try to put a stop to that awful war. And I got radicalized, of course, during that time. There was a time when we, you know, took over the streets of Philadelphia in a spontaneous protest and marched down around the Liberty Bell. And, you know, 500 or 600 people made this giant human peace sign. And there was a TV crew there, and they ran their TV camera up this telescoping pole off of their van. And you could tell for sure that they got an amazing shot, right? A couple hundred people forming a human peace sign outside the Liberty Bell. Great graphics, right? I was sure that that was going to be on the evening news. But what showed up instead was like about a 6-second clip that showed three of our most, you know, freakish looking people yelling, complemented by all three of the counter protesters who were across the street on a street corner. And that was the coverage. And I was like, no, this is just so wrong. So I was totally hooked at that point. And so after graduation, I went to Washington, D.C. to try to see if there was some way to make a difference from the inside. I went to work as a staff member for a Democratic member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and frankly got disillusioned very, very quickly, just in the opportunity to make a difference on big issues from the inside. It was easy to see sitting at that desk that, you know, the things that made a difference were people that had big money connections and groups that had serious grassroots heft, like the Sierra Club. So then I found my way off of Capitol Hill, thankfully, to start working in advocacy campaigns. I got to work for a really fun campaign that was about asserting Generation X's voice in politics. And we had so much fun calling up and sort of generating these grassroots bird dogging events where students would find out when candidates X and Y were going to show up somewhere. And we would show up with this great little media stunt and bring the cameras with us. And we got all these incumbents and their challengers to sign these great pledges on this issue I was working on at the time. And that was just so fun because we was like a boiler room of like six of us, basically kids making phone calls and causing trouble all around the country. And it was a really powerful experience. And so then I basically, from that point on, dedicated my career to grassroots organizing and media organizing and building organizations with greater and greater capacity to do this kind of work. Because if you're going to be on the side of grassroots organizing rather than the side of big money, the ultimate metric is how many people can you get involved? And, you know, you can do a certain amount directly, but at a certain point, you have to have an organization that grows, that has the capacity to bring people in and uses technology effectively. And also, you know, is smart enough to take care of its people so that they can take good care of the volunteers and operates with integrity so you follow through on your promises and et cetera, and which not every group necessarily does. So that's been basically the commitment of my career.
Isn't it true that one of the organizations you formed then merged into Move On? Is that how you found yourself part of that group?
Yeah, that's right. When I was doing my graduate work at Yale, I felt that there was a big unmet opportunity in getting Generations X and Y involved in politics because they basically weren't involved as young people. And I also felt like with the arrival of the internet, there was a potential for scale. And there was also an opportunity to kind of change the prevailing dynamic where some central decision makers decide what's going to happen. And then they broadcast the action alerts and the plans out to the field. Given the many-to-many nature of the internet, there's an opportunity to put the participants in charge of setting the agenda as well as pushing out the activism around it. And I got really excited about that. So I created an organization while I was in school called Generation Net and worked with amazing people there too. As it happens, Stacey Abrams, who is, of course, famous today, was then at Yale Law School, and she is just so truly amazing. I had the opportunity to work with her as a member of the board of directors at Generation Net. She first joined the board and then served as our board president. And we had Wes Boyd, who is the principal founder of MoveOn.org, come onto our advisory board along with Gavin Newsom, the current governor of California, of course, and a lot of other amazing people. We ran a campaign and we got a little tiny bit of traction and then essentially ran out of gas. But we had a very common vision with the vision that Wes and Joan, who founded MoveOn, had, which was putting the grassroots members of an organization in charge of setting its agenda. So in early 2001, we decided to merge, and I had the honor of serving as MoveOn's founding executive director for the next 4 years.
I think it's too infrequent that we see mergers in the progressive ecosystem. Were you both so young that it wasn't difficult, or were there challenges to coming into another organization?
Well, Wes is about 10 years older than I am. The organizations were similarly new. We brought somewhat complementary assets to the table. MoveOn, of course, had launched and it had grown, you know, a fraction of its current size, but already gigantic by the standards then. It had grown to 350,000 people at the time that we merged, whereas Generation Net had about 600, so it was really negligible. They had a list, and they had a history of successfully fundraising from that list. They have done PAC fundraising from that list to support congressional candidates to challenge the impeachment managers from the Clinton impeachment, which, of course, was how MoveOn was founded. The mission that we set out to build for MoveOn as an ongoing advocacy group was basically to advance policy and to stop bad policies. And that, of course, is a 501c4 function. And to raise money for a 501c4, you can't get tax-deductible gifts to support legislative advocacy beyond a certain limit. So you really need to, and especially if you want to do sort of electoral bird dogging, you have to have 501c4 money. There was no 501c4 online fundraising engine off the shelf. There was no ActBlue in those days. The only online fundraising engines you could get for nonprofits were restricted to 501c3s because nobody even understood really what a 501c4 was at that time. The lawyers did, but nobody else in the movement did. When I was at school, I had won a business plan competition for Generation Net and raised, you know, won a $10,000 prize and used that to pay a friend to build from scratch a 501c4 online fundraising engine. So we had that ready to basically point the MoveOn list at, and that's how we raised the initial budget for MoveOn 501c4. So we had, you know, a couple of assets. I was personally really dedicated to building an organization. And what Wes and Joan were saying at the time was they had built this asset and this list, but that they really weren't sure that they wanted to continue to, you know, have it be their full-time pursuit. They were thinking they wanted to do other things with their lives, and so they were thinking of, you know, maybe giving the list to some other organization. And I was very clear that I thought there was a big opportunity to turn that list into a group with an ongoing voice, and so I advocated hard for that, and I'm very happy that they went in that direction.
I mean, that seems like a really pivotal role and job for you for 4 years. Can you talk a little bit about what you ended up doing and how that feels in retrospect?
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, absolutely. There's no question that finding myself as the executive director of MoveOn.org straight out of grad school was unbelievable. The thing that might be harder to imagine today, you know, for people hearing this is that, you know, at that time, MoveOn was already the major player in online politics, but that didn't mean nearly as much then as it does today. You know, they had built a list, they'd run basically the first effective online petition, and they'd raised a few million dollars for congressional candidates. But beyond like people paying close attention to politics, nobody had ever heard about them, and they were not an advocacy presence, and they weren't making really big ripples yet. So basically, it was like having this enormous asset of, you know, 3.5 million members that we could basically deploy for all kinds of advocacy campaigns. And yet amazingly enough, nobody really understood the power of it. So I was in Washington for about a year, beginning right around 9/11, as it happened. Of course, right after that, that was a super toxic political climate to be in. President George W. Bush was, you know, and Cheney, of course, were ruthlessly building and exploiting a climate of fear and scaring everybody basically into submission. That's how the Patriot Act got passed. And they were trying to do a lot of awful, awful stuff. The first thing they tried to do was to use the Defense Authorization Bill as an excuse to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in the North Slope of Alaska to oil drilling, which, of course, is, you know, it's totally sacred. And there's no way we should do that. And thankfully, we haven't done it yet. But having this list of 3.5 million people basically at our fingertips, we could send out an email alert and say, hell no, don't do that. And we could generate just a massive number of phone calls to Capitol Hill at a time when basically nobody else had that capacity. So we were able to use that asset, all of these people's voices, to really make a difference on all kinds of issues where the environmental movement just didn't have that kind of grassroots capacity. The tax fairness movement didn't have that kind of grassroots capacity. And of course, when Bush mounted his case for the second war in Iraq, you know, there was basically no peace movement at the time. The groups that were out there were basically just, there was nobody really, really active on that. And so Bouvan, of course, famously stepped into that void and became best known for that at the time. And we were also able to do some really important stuff that basically flew below the radar in most cases. But, you know, you look at politics today, a lot of the reasons why we're so screwed and why Contest Every Race's work is so important, a lot of it comes down to America's courts and the fact that the Supreme Court is packed with right-wing authoritarians and pro-corporate people, and the lower courts as well. It was clear the last conservative nominee who'd gotten onto the Supreme Court at that time had been, if I remember correctly, Clarence Thomas, and it was pretty clear that there were going to be more openings, and we needed to make sure that we didn't just roll over for them. So we mounted a campaign for the Senate to filibuster a judicial nominee for the D.C. Circuit Appellate Court named Miguel Estrada, who was following the Clarence Thomas playbook of being an ethnic minority, saying nothing, and basically daring the Democrats to find the spine to oppose him. And with our help, they did. They filibustered Miguel Estrada. He withdrew his name from consideration. And that was the first time in the sort of the horror show after 9/11 that the Democrats found the collective will to stand up to President Bush on anything. So that was a real turning point moment that we played a key role in. And it was pretty fun.
It must have been more than fun to sort of feel some power to make a difference in politics, to have gone from, you know, more of a line soldier to a leader. What occasioned you leaving a job like that?
I've been there for 4 years. MoveOn was in really stable place. You know, we grew the membership to 3 million. There were really talented people working there. Eli Pariser in particular, who had came in to run our Iraq work and ended up becoming the executive director of the MoveOn PAC. Extremely capable, extremely talented. It just didn't seem like there was as much for me to contribute at a certain point.
What did you do next?
Took some time, did a lot of yoga, rested a lot, helped various groups do various things. I worked for a group called Free Speech for People for a while. I think they've been on your podcast as well, helping lead their campaign to amend the U.S. Constitution to overturn the Citizens United decision, which of course is infamous. And I gradually gave myself space to work on another project that's very dear to my heart. If you don't mind, I'll talk about that for just a couple of minutes.
Please.
It's called One Global Democracy. And one of the great things about working at MoveOn at that time was that I had the opportunity to really see across the landscape, you know, where is their organizational strength and where are the gaps? And of course, one of the gaps is in candidate recruitment, which is why we're doing what we're doing now. Another one is in actually having a conversation about whether countries still make sense or not. And I realize that might sound pretty naive or starry-eyed or utopian, but I think there are actually really practical arguments to be made that they don't make sense anymore. I mean, if you look at the need to grapple with climate change, the sovereignty of separate countries is the point of failure in global cooperation to deal with an intrinsically global problem. If you look at inequality, at the core of inequality, you have corporations that evade accountability by locating essentially fictitious headquarters in other countries beyond the reach of taxation and accountability. And you have individuals stashing trillions of dollars in tax havens like Panama. And with those conditions, there's no way you can possibly have adequate redistribution or adequate social investment. And so it just doesn't work. And you look at even things today like, you know, global response to global pandemics. This notion that we have separate countries whose defining attribute is a lack of accountability to anyone beyond their borders, it's absolutely suicidal for us as a species and as a planetary ecosystem. And to my amazement, there simply isn't an organization, at least as far as I'm aware, on the national stage that's trying to make a cogent argument for why we should move beyond that and make that argument and beyond the sort of Saturday night campfire context and where you sometimes hear people talk about that, John Lennon songs, but bringing that argument into the sober light of day. And I personally find that pretty compelling. So in my spare time, I work to advance that cause.
I can hear the hackles being raised by that concept among many people. You know, of course, the nationalists that are currently running the country and those in other parts of the world, if there was one democracy tackling big things, it would be a big plus. If you had someone or power at the head of that spoke to the whole earth that was taking you the wrong direction, the Bolsonaros or the Trumps, then it seems scary. How do you think about like the promise and the risk?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I should just bookmark this. I mean, I don't know if you'd be open to it, but I would love to do a whole podcast on this topic because I could go on and on and on about this. You know, this is my most deeply held values. So to try to answer your question briefly, you know, I think if you're going to look at a global democracy, you have to imagine that paper ballots are the gold standard today, and that's great. And at some point, paper ballots are not going to scale globally. So you've got to imagine some kind of technological support. And most likely, I think there's an opportunity that's emerging now with blockchain technology. Now, blockchain has a host of issues, but there continues to be improvement and iteration. And I think it's reasonably likely that at some point in the not-so-distant future, it will be not just technologically feasible, but realistically scalable to have every person on the planet have a blockchain-verified digital identity that's, you know, verifiably unique to them. And based on that, also through probably blockchain platforms of one kind or another, be able to either cast a vote directly on policy, any individual, anywhere, or if they prefer to delegate their vote through a flexible proxy system that's best known as liquid democracy, where, you know, if you care, if you know enough to know how you feel about issue X, you just cast your vote. But maybe it's about climate change. So maybe you want to give your proxy to Al Gore. But maybe you get concerned at some point that Al Gore hypothetically, you know, loses his bearings. I don't think that's likely to happen, but hypothetically it could. You might want to reassign your proxy on climate change to someone like Bill McKibben, and you could do that instantaneously. That's the beauty of liquid democracy. So the way that backs out to the answer to your question is you don't necessarily have to have democracy defined as we're used to seeing it defined as, you know, pick A or B person to vote in your stead and you get a voice in who that is once every 2, 4, or 6 years. Instead, you could have a direct voice on the policy itself. The whole model of representative democracy is it goes back, you know, it goes back to the horse and buggy era. Technology has moved so far beyond that.
It is worth longer discussion and maybe more political, philosophical expertise than I bring to bear. But let's take that as the answer for now.
That sounds great.
I've taken a fair amount of your time, but just would you mind talking for a second about what you see going into the 2020 election, how you feel about the guy we got that we're trying to beat for the presidency, and just where you feel the country is at this point in history?
Wow.
Small question.
That's such a great question. Obviously, the orange man is reprehensible and he's got to go. Hopefully, and I'm starting to feel cautiously optimistic that he has ripped the veil off of all of our eyes, and increasing numbers of Americans, they're becoming really disenchanted. And I think he's going to take a lot of Republican senators out with him. Now, I don't know if we'll have fair votes. I don't know if the votes will even be tallied. Georgia, for example, raises all kinds of questions about whether we're going to be able to have a democracy. It may already be gone. It's hard to know. But if we are able to have the votes cast and counted, it's not time to be complacent. We've all got to work our tails off, and everyone at Contest Every Race and everyone at Resistance Labs is going to continue to do that every day from now till November and past if necessary. At this point, the wind is at our back, and I think it's pretty exciting to see what kind of house cleaning we could have if we're successful.
Agreed. There's a long way to go and many tricks and lies to navigate before we get there. I hope that where we are now is where we are then. Peter, it's really an honor to talk to you. Is there a question that I didn't ask that you wish I had?
Oh, wow. Well, Nathaniel, the honor's really been mine. I think we need to start talking about making the Republican Party illegal. I think we need to start talking about treating it the way Germany has treated the Nazi Party. It is unconstitutional in Germany to be affiliated with the Nazi Party. And I think the Republican Party has given us more than adequate cause to treat it the same way. I think we have to start thinking about accountability with really clear eyes, because if we don't, if we repeat the approach that Obama followed after George W. Bush, where he basically gave all the war criminals amnesty, all you do is you teach them that there's no consequence for just flagrant abuse of power and for destroying things that are sacred. And, you know, we're seeing today that doesn't work with police, and, you know, it can't work at a national government level either.
It seems to me the way that you teach a party that they're wrong is you have to repudiate them at the polls. I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of making them illegal. We need two parties. I agree with you that they're, you know, right now a terrible party, and they've kind of folded for a very, very bad leader with serious personality problems and position problems. But that doesn't seem like a wholly democratic solution. It makes me uncomfortable anyway. And there is quite a distance between this horrible Republican Party and the Nazi Party. I don't know. They're not putting people in ovens. So
not yet. Kids in cages, though. Kids in cages.
That's very bad. In any case, we don't have to be in the same exact place to be on the same team. And that's really one thing that I've felt strongly as I've talked to people across the spectrum of what I think are allies in this cause right now, which range from people well left of me to people well right of me, that when you face as existential a threat as we do with Trump and the Republicans right now, we need this energy and these ideas, and we need to team up. So I'm glad you're on the team. I think the work that you're doing at Contest Every Race is, what I like about it is it's so practical. It is so clear, and anyone can grasp that this is a plan that has value. It's measurable. So, you know, I think you're in a good spot. I'm glad for that. So thanks again for taking the time. Is there anything else you want to say?
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Peter Sherman and Contest Every Race. Peter's at contesteveryrace.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a great Battlefield podcast.
You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.